VLT Bangalore welcomes you to today's short talk on the subject Good Thoughts, Good Words, Good Deeds. Now, topic primarily deals with ethics, morality. So let's examine what is the present society, the prevalent ideas in the present society about goodness and ethics. The question is asked, why should we do what is good? Why should we follow ethics? We find various reasons. First is the fear of consequences of human law. That is, if you do something wrong which goes against what the law of the land says, then you may be caught, you may be jailed, punished. So there are social implications around that. But if you are able to hoodwink the law, if you are able to circumvent the law, then you can as well do it. If you are able to find loopholes, structure, you may as well take advantage of it. For example, finding a very clever chartered accountant or a lawyer who will be able to twist and turn and, you know, fight the case for you and win it for you. So in that case, it's okay, go ahead, do it. So as long as you don't get caught, you are safe. So that's one way of looking at good and evil. Then there is another class of people for whom there is a fear of God. There is a set of commandments, rules supposed to be given by God. And if it is broken, then after death, you will face the hellfire. Or you will face boiling oil in which you will be drowned. Or you may be reborn as an animal, this animal, that animal, and struggle. That's another kind of fear of consequence. But we are too clever and we have found an escape mechanism there also. So the orthodox and the priest class comes. You do this ritual, you do that prayer, you do this, that and the other thing, and you will be able to escape the consequences of your action. So in human affairs, there are these clever CAs and lawyers. In the celestial affairs, we have replaced another set of people, or priests, priestcraft, and the exoteric outer religion, right? Then there is those other class of people who are educated under modern scientific ideas, and whose predominant thinking is colored by modern scientific understanding. For them, ethics does not exist at all in nature. In reality, there is no ethics. For such a person, ethics is a human construct. It is derived out of human thinking. If you look at the various sciences and its classification, this becomes very clear. Ethics is derived from socio-economic sciences. In the modern scientific context, is derived from socio-economic sciences. Socio-economic sciences gets its roots from geological sciences, biological sciences, and other sciences which is classified. Now, biological science is taken from biology, geological sciences from xenosciences. Both of these meet at what is called as the central science, which is chemistry. So from chemistry, there is a branching that happens. Xenosciences, human biological sciences, electronic and computer sciences, all of which feeds into your socio-economic science, from which your laws and ethics are derived. Where does chemistry come from? You go further. It comes from physics. Physics. Physics comes from mathematical models. Mathematical models finally arises ability of human mind to think, ratiocination. So ethics is the lowermost derivation of human mind. Ethics does not exist in nature. There is no morality in nature. That is the modern scientific understanding. So looking at good and bad from this angle, you find that good and evil is at best of functional value. In other words, what is good? Your thoughts, words and deeds are good when it is good for yourself, when it is convenient for yourself. So that's the meaning that we can draw from this. So that's about the present society and the condition in which it is in. But let's look at what the ancient science said. There were ancient scientists and they had far deeper, profounder understanding of nature and man than the present day science. While the present day science sees the physical world and examines it very sincerely, the ancient science dived deeper into the invisible but more real realms of being. So they recognized, these ancient scientists recognized, these ancient sages recognized, that there is an implicate order in the universe. This is the primary thing to be understood. It's not a construct of human mind, and irrespective of whether a human being is able to comprehend it or not comprehend it, there is an implicate order, right? Implicate order. In this was mentioned in all the ancient scriptures, which is worthy of mention. Among the Vedas, it was called as Rita. Unfortunately, modern-day Hindus don't even know this word, most of us. Whereas this is a cardinal, vital, most crucial concept to be understood if you have to understand the Vedas. What does Ritam mean? Ritam means truth or order, cosmic order. There is an implicate cosmic order. Among the Zoroastrians, they recognized this order and called this Asha. Asha. The Egyptians symbolized this as the goddess of Maat, goddess of Maat, who was the goddess of fairness, virtue and justice. Among the Chinese, we find it as Tao, Tao. And among the Sufis and the Sikhs and some of the Arab writers, you find it means order, hukum. They all recognize that there is an implicate order in the universe. There is a moral order in the cosmos. Now, okay, there is this moral order. What does it mean to us? What it means to us is the topic of this talk, which is we have three modes of action, three avenues of action. One is the mind. Next is the speech, third is the body. And in each of these, we can either maintain this cosmic moral order or we can disturb this cosmic moral order, which is why it is called as Trikarna. Karna means instrument, means. The means or instrument by which action is affected is Karna. So each being, each of us manages to have Trikarna or three avenues of action. And what the sages said is that all your past, entirety of your present and the whole of your future is the result or it is determined by the actions that have been performed through these three means. So this is what Buddha was telling, which we read from the Dhammapada, that all that we are is the result of what we have thought, is founded on our thoughts, formed of our thoughts. So none of the ancient teachers thought that it's the God who is punishing you. No, they never thought that. Neither is it the planetary configuration which is resulting in some maleficent effect, bringing calamity on you, therefore do this puja, that puja. No, they never thought that. The genes and the environment which affect us nor are our parents and heredity responsible for our tendencies. Because what are all these? The genes, heredity, and the various things that we refer to in this context are but the physical means through which our own tendencies and the causes that we have set up in the past work itself out. We have set up some causes in the past and it work itself out in terms of our genes and the environment that we are in, our opportunities in life, the misfortunes in life, the trouble that comes to us from others, the help that comes to us from a friend. They are not the originators of it, they are the means through which our own actions, which was affected through mind, speech and action, comes back to us. So, in each of these three avenues of thought, word and deed, the sages said that we had always two choices. Either you can maintain this justice and harmony, which is ratam, or you can break it. So you choose what you want to do. But once the choice is made, the effect of it will have to be, the consequences of it will have to be faced by you. You have free will to choose, but you can't say that I don't want the consequences of it. Once you set the causes in motion, the causes will bring about its effects.
Which can't be tried.
Not only that, they said that the moment you do anything, the slightest thought that appears, the word that you pronounce, or any deed that you do, has a tendency to repeat itself. Because everything in nature is cyclic. Law of cycles is fundamental to nature, which means anything that we do has a tendency to come back again, to repeat itself. It's a cyclic return of the impression that we have created, whether on the plane of mind, speech or on body. And it is through these repeated impressions and strengthening it by working along a certain line that we form our habits. And habit continued over long series, long period of time, becomes our character. So where do we get our character from? We get it from the past tendencies that we have generated and strengthened. In the Bhagavad Gita, this is very nicely explained, where a certain downward course is mentioned in the second chapter of the Gita. Krishna is warning Arjuna against giving into sense pleasures. And he says, by the mere inclination towards one's senses and its pleasures, you create a concern about them. That concern, carried over a period of time, turns into passion. And that passion turns into anger. Why? The moment your passion is not appeased, you get angry. So passion leads to anger. Anger leads to delusion. Delusion leads to loss of memory. Memory of what? Memory of what is right and wrong.
Discrimination.
This loss of memory leads to loss of discrimination. And once your discrimination is lost, everything is lost. Your whole life is lost. So here Krishna is speaking of how a single thought, a feeling that appears in your mind, when unattended and allowed to grow and work upon the same line, it leads to action. Or on the other hand, it leads to the highest good. So this is why in the Mahabharata, when Yudhishthira was asked the question, what is the greatest duty of man? The greatest duty of man, says Yudhishthira, is self-restraint. Self-restraint. Because the tendency of the mind, as we are situated now, is towards evil. Because we are situated among desires. In the body, in the desires, very close to desires. So our tendency is to do wrong, therefore self-restraint becomes the first duty. And next point is, okay, we have generated all these tendencies, these habits in us. What happens to all this? When we die, all these things do not die and go away. These are all strong energies that we have generated, which have the tendency to repeat it. And unless we have removed, eliminated a certain defect from our nature, we carry it forward to the next life. And it, in the next life, it manifests itself again, like we have some innate tendencies, character and capacities of our mind, some proclivities. These are all what we have carried forward from our past. So therefore, this ancient sages who recognize the moral order of the universe and the three modes of action said that this Trikarna Shuddhi has to be effected. And this is what was true spirituality. True spirituality was good thoughts, good words and good deeds. This is the very essence of our spiritual life, and not any rituals and ceremonies and so on. So the moment we understand how instantly acting, whether on the plane of mind, body or speech, even when we are sleeping, we are acting, because the mind is active on a different plane. And each of these sets causes in motion. Then we find how responsible we are, because each of these will bring about its consequences, its effects. Not only do we realize that, naturally, if we are constantly acting, then we have the power to change the present circumstances. We are not what we are as written in stone. We have the power to change ourselves because we have the power to act along different lines. Say we have a certain habit that we have developed. We are not the victims of it. We are actually the creators of that habit. As long as we keep feeding that habit, feeding that addiction, it keeps strengthening itself through our mental and physical energy dedicated towards it. So the point is to withdraw that and then set up causes in its opposite direction. Better habits, good habits. So there is a lot of optimism in understanding this, how this law of action and its reaction works. Among these three avenues of action, the most potent of these three, which is the most potent, most powerful? If you ask a normal man of present society, he will say action, physical action, deed is the most powerful. What you think and speak and all is okay. What you do is what is important. But actually, it is our thoughts, feelings and emotions which are the most potent and which bring about the most marked results. Physical carrying out of a certain action is a consequence. It will also have its effects, no questions about it. But the potent part of it is in the thought, our imagination, our feelings, our intentions and motives. This is because, what is thought? Thought is not the product of brain. In fact, thought doesn't belong to the biochemical aspect of man at all. Thought is a very fine thing. It belongs to the plane of mind. Its origin is in mind. And mind, again, is not a product of brain. Mind is independent of brain. Mind is superior to brain. Mind is an independent entity. And this mind uses brain to come in contact with the physical world. Brain and the senses, physical instruments or the doorways, the gateways, the windows through which contact with the physical world happens. Experience is drawn from the physical world through these So the distinction that is drawn is the distinction between a veena player, a great musician, and the instrument, which is the veena itself. The veena is not creating music. It is a musician who is using the veena and then weaving musical notes. But the instrument also is necessary to work on this plane, so brain is necessary. So that's the relationship. And where does mind come from? Mind comes from its parent, which is universal mind. Individual mind comes from universal mind, which means that all the powers that are there in the universal mind is present in each one of us. This is what was meant when all the ancient teachers said that each man is potentially a Buddha or a Tirthankara. Because the potentiality of the highest development, which is expressed by a Buddha or a Tirthankara, is latently present in each one of us. So all these great, very strong cosmic forces are all latently present in our mind. And it is these powers of the mind that we are using at every moment of our life. So we can imagine what is the power of our thoughts. And look at this. Our mind, body, and the power of speech do not belong to us. We study the evolution of the soul, we find that all these three modes of action are actually loaned to us by nature. Nature provides these instruments, these mechanisms for the soul to come in touch with nature, to experience and to realize its oneness with its parent soul. For this process of evolution, all this body, the senses, the brain, the mind, the power of speech, and all the inner faculties and powers, these are all loaned to us by nature. They are given as a loan. It doesn't belong to us. In the Dhammapada, this is what Buddha mentioned when he said, you yourself don't belong to yourself. And you are thinking that your son belongs to you, and so on. Attahi attano natti. You yourself don't belong to yourself. All this is your what the nature has given to you to be used for the purpose which nature intends, and to be returned back. And the purpose for which nature has given all these instruments is the purpose of experience and emancipation of the soul. That's what Yoga Aphorisms of Patanjali say. In order to come in touch with nature, gather experience, experience of good and evil, and through that learn what is the right thing to do, do the right thing, and then progress further. And if we forget this, and then use all these things as and subordinate all our senses and faculties to desire, it will be as good as prostituting our powers. It has been given for some purpose, we are misusing and abusing these powers. When we do this, this is the first and great way of breaking this cosmic order that we were speaking of. Ritam or hukum. The order is this, that every soul emanates like a spark from the universal oversoul. Like a spark from the fire, the spark containing all the potentialities of the fire, every soul, which is everything, what is soul? Everything is soul, emanates from this one central fire or central sun. And then it has to go through the pilgrimage in the world of matter. So we are all pilgrim souls going through the world of matter to gain experience, gather experience. To what purpose? to realize that each soul is not distinct from anybody else. Each soul is one with all others, and all are but reflections of the one soul, one universal oversoul, spirit. For this purpose, nature provides various vehicles and three modes of action: thought, speech, and deed. And man forgets this, misuses it, and brings down all kinds of calamities on himself. Which is why the ancient sages insisted on purification of the three modes of action: thought, word, and deed. So, these thoughts are so powerful. You are angry at someone, or you have revengeful feelings. You are hurt by someone, so you want revenge. You don't need to do anything. Your mere thought, the feeling of negativity that you have, on the inner plane, it has already hurt him. It has already set about great disturbances in you and around you. And it comes back to you in this life or in any of the subsequent lives, and between you both, where he or she becomes an obstacle on your path. Then you worry, oh, why is he troubling me? Why should she trouble me? I didn't do anything wrong to him. That's because you have set up such negative causes in your past. And you may not have physically done harm to him or her, but the very thought, feeling that you engender in your heart is enough. This is also what Jesus was telling to his disciples, that he who looks with lust on another's wife has already committed adultery. Physical committing is only a consequence. Your very thoughts, feelings is the real act itself. Because man is a mind being. He is not the biochemical, neurological body. That's his instrument. He is a mind being, as real to us in our true nature as this table or chair is real to our body. So thoughts are very, very potent, and therefore the sages always asked us to guard our thoughts. And true discipline started with our mind, not with, you know, doing two times of bathing and pranayama, not that at all. So this is something very important. So we are not even aware of the power of our thought, what is the havoc that it is causing. So we must get acquainted with this. So that is one part of what our thought does. There is another consequence of our thought, each of our thoughts and feelings. The moment an idea, feeling, thought arises in our brain, it makes an impression on the inner sphere, on the inner plane, you may say. You may say mind. It makes a picture of our thought or our feeling. So the plane of mind is impressed with each one of our thoughts and feelings. This is what was called as the astral light, right? It is filled with emotions, pictures of our emotions, feelings, and thoughts. So the general kind of thought we all have, the present society, the level, the caliber of our thoughts, we all know: greed, anger, violence, lust, selfishness. Each one of us contribute to that. In our personal life, if we are lax in following the path of righteousness, we are constantly impressing this inner plane with our thoughts, with such kind of thoughts and feelings. And what happens to these? This inner plane is like a mirror. Just like if my vehicle causes pollution on the road, it affects me as well as affects all others around me. It doesn't disappear, right? It affects, causes respiratory problems, all other problems. Similarly, the pollution of our heart and mind, which is impressed on this inner plane, reflects back upon the minds of all others. This is why many sensitives, people of sensitive nature and who are weak, are impelled to commit crime. And many of them say, it's come in various, if you read carefully, it had come in National Geographic also. They say, something took control over me and impelled me to do this. Were I to be in my present state of mind, I wouldn't have done it. But I was impelled by some irresistible force. All the crimes that we see committed, let us not disown that criminal and condemn him and hang him. We may have as much contributed in his crime that he has committed. He is weak, he acted on that. His circumstances were such that he acted along that impulse. But we might have as well inspired him to commit those crimes. So the power of human thought is very, very, very dynamic, and it's a great force that we all have, great responsibility that is entrusted on us. So not only is this true for negative thoughts, that was just given as an example, all the feelings of love, of goodness, charitable attitude towards others, and the feeling of rendering good to the person who did us evil, all these things impress very beautiful and noble altruistic pictures on this inner plane of mind. And those also have an effect on all other minds and inspire them to do good, to be good. So by purifying oneself, one's heart and mind in one's private life, we can bring about great social changes. The outer reform that we do in the social field, economic field, political field, they are all merely effects. The real change that has to be brought about is on the plane of thought, feeling and intentions and motives. And the secret doctrine says that the energy that we expend on the physical plane brings about certain effects, right? We use our physical energy, do something, it brings about certain effects. But the same amount it is expended on the plane of mind brings about far greater results, far reaching results, and great variety of results, because of the very plane of thought being more subtle, more fine than the plane of physical matter. By the very nature of its fineness, its caliber, it brings about far greater results. So this is something which shows how potent our thoughts are compared to mere physical action. And it is on this basis that the ancient said, when you give a gift to someone, the value of that gift, the benefit of that gift, is not merely in the monetary worth. It is primarily determined by your intention and motive. This is very clearly brought out in probably the 17th chapter of the Gita, where giving gifts is classified according to three gunas. The sattvic is when there is no return of benefit which is expected from that person. He knows who is the right person to give, how much to give, when to give. He doesn't want any returns from it. He doesn't give it scornfully. He gives it with full of wisdom, and he doesn't even want any spiritual benefits flowing therefrom. Rajasic is when there is some expectation. Tamasic is completely indifferent. Tamasic and Rajasic bring about its own deleterious, bad consequences. And this is a sattvic which we have to try. All this goes on to show that the ancients understood far well that it is the thinking and our heart, our emotions, which play a great role in our action. That is what color That is the true color of man, not the outward. He may be seen as a great philanthropist, but inwardly, if there is any expectation, then it is tinted with selfishness, and it brings about a different kind of results. So therefore, we come back to the importance of good thoughts, good words, good deeds, because our deeds and words proceeds from our thoughts. So the primary thing has to be affected is correction of our mind, correction of our thinking. By taking the right philosophy of life and removing erroneous thinking is the best benefit that we can give to oneself as well as all others. And this is very important, because as was said earlier, we have a responsibility towards all others. And how we live our life, though we may be physically disconnected with others, how we live our life has an effect on the progress of the race towards higher goals, impelling the race towards higher and higher stages of evolution of the soul, or hindering the whole evolutionary march. This evolutionary march that we see from lower forms of intelligence to higher is actually a expression of that ritam, order. There is a cosmic order. And in our life, if we are full of vice, then we are hindering that order. So we have responsibility not only to ourselves, but to all other beings around us. And their progress depends on us. Their progress depends on each one of us. So it's not individual moksha. They also run towards moksha and then acquire it, just like you would run a running race or in a career run and become the CEO. It's not individual moksha. It's the salvation of the all emancipation of all sentient beings, which is the true aim which you get when you study the scriptures correctly. And another important point is that when we set our family life, our personal life in order, it is actually a protection to all those around us, protection from lot of evil. Because like attracts like. If in our life we are full of evil, we attract evil to ourselves and as well as those around us. Simple question of like attracting like. And if we are righteous, then we extend a natural protection which comes from doing good to all those around us silently. This is what in the Genesis you find an incident where Abraham is in conversation with the Lord God, and Lord God says to Abraham that in a city, if I find only 10 righteous people, then I will not destroy it. 10 righteous people are enough in a city to save that city. This is the hidden meaning of it. How each person doing right, following the path of dharma, righteousness, produces beneficent effect on those around him. So finally, all this we will close here with remembering or recollecting a very nice symbolical, allegorical story from the Zoroastrian, the Persian scriptures. All this is very beautifully epitomized in this small story. Now, it is the Zoroastrian says that there is a good spirit called Ormazd, and then there is an evil destructive spirit called Ahriman. And it is said that there is a constant tussle between this good spirit and evil spirit. So there is a story of how these good and evil spirits came into existence. It is said that Zeruan was the deity, the one deity. He was alone, but he desired offspring. And desiring offspring, he wanted those offspring who would create heaven, hell and everything in between. So he did sacrifice for 1000 years. See, look at that. Even the one deity performs sacrifice. But we don't perform it. We have forgotten the path of sacrifice. Right? So anyway, so the Zeruan sacrifice for 1000 years. Now mind you, all these are very symbolical, allegorical. We should not take it literally. Right? So he performed sacrifice for 1000 years to have this progeny. And almost nearing the end of sacrifice, doubt creeps into his mind, saying, is this efficacious or not? At that moment of doubt, twins are born. These twins are Ormuzd and Ahriman. Ormuzd is born out of the 1000 years of sacrifice. Ahriman is born of that one moment of doubt. So Ormuzd and Ahriman are in the womb now. And so Zeruan says, whoever is the first born out of these both, for him I will give the kingship, the sovereignty of all created beings. Then Ormuzd understands this and conveys it to his younger brother Ahriman. Ahriman is an evil spirit. So he preempts Ormuzd, climbs up, rips open the womb and comes up first, saying, I want the kingship. I want the sovereignty. Right? And then Zeruan has already made the promise. So he concedes it, but with a clause. He says, for the first 9000 years, Ahriman will rule. And then Ormuzd will overcome Ahriman and he will rule forever. So those who read SD volume 2 will probably understand this much better, anthropogenesis. But in its application to our psycho-spiritual evolution, we may say that Ormuzd or the higher light, the divine light, is the divine mind in us. Ahriman, the lower, the deceitful spirit, is our lower self, kama manas, lower manas. And there is a constant tussle between these two. At every moment there is a fight between these two. The Zoroaster says that in this tussle, what is the role of man? Man is not a bystander, mind you. Man has said to have a very crucial role in this fight between good and evil, because his critical role is in his own life. He is an active participant in this war between good and evil, because he has to defend Asha or Ratam. That is his duty. He aids Ormuzd by conforming his life, his personal life, in the line of cosmic order, Ratam. And the means to do this is very beautifully given. They call it Dena or Din, which is the same as Dharma or Dhamma. And that is epitomized in three words, which is the topic of our today's lecture. Good thoughts, good words, good deeds. These are the means man aids Ormuzd in defeating Ahriman and making Ormuzd, which is the good spirit, reign over all the created beings. So they call it Hubata, Hukta, Huvarshta. Good thoughts, good words, good deeds. So it's a duty incumbent on all of us. It's not of sentimental value, it's not something sentimental. The very fact of our existence implies that we have duty towards all others, because we are interrelated. And performance of that duty, Dena, and letting the cosmic order in motion, is through these three: good thoughts, good words and good deeds. So let's stop here and take